Looks like the Browns are out. This is Paul Rodell, once more, oral history project for IBS. And today is July 15th. And I'm in the home of Lou Wolf, who was a Laos volunteer 64 through 67. And I guess that's the basic introduction. And I've already explained off tape the first question that we've been starting everybody off with, the question that could not actually be put in on the original form. And that is your own influences, where and when you were born, what your parents were like, how you were brought up, the influences on you, the youthful Lou Wolf that decided, that, you know, that helped you decide that you wanted to go into this organization, IBS. So now I get to pretty much shut up, although I may chirp in from time to time and let you tell your own story.
I grew up, I was born in 1940, actually on Halloween, grew up on a farm outside Philadelphia. In those days it was about 30 miles outside Philadelphia. Today it's just virtually part of Philadelphia proper, right on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. In fact, when the Turnpike came through in 1956, it sliced through our farm, and my parents sold the farm as a result, to my great dismay at the time. Growing up on a farm and having farm responsibilities, though we had my father also worked in the city, and we had somebody who farmed the farm, and I was essentially a helper. I did milking and plowing sometimes, but that's quite a cup, isn't it?
This is an amazing cup. This is not a stealth B-2 bomber cup. Is not exactly what I expect to find in your house.
it was sent to us, a friend in California. thought I'd appreciate it.
When it heats up, the thing shows up better? Is that it? I'm sorry.
All the lights start blinking.
Yeah. Bombs drop.
And loved the farm life, and the Gerald Ford. Dolores collects plates and all kinds of political plates and cups and everything. So, and essentially, I became, influence, part of the influence, I guess, although it was later on, but part of the influence was growing up in a rural situation, but going to school in the city and then coming home again. Obviously, rural Philadelphia is not the same even in the 40s and 50s as Laos, clearly. But I went to college. I went to a Quaker school, Germantown Friends School. I actually spent 14 years there, including kindergarten. I graduated in 1958 with a very mediocre achievement level. Barely graduated, actually, but got into learning along about the 11th grade, I guess. Before that, I wasn't really much interested. Ended up at Goddard College in Vermont quite almost by accident, because at the high school they didn't tell me that even in 1958 when I graduated that I would need to have two foreign languages to graduate, to get admission rather. And
do you have to answer that?
I guess I should, yeah.
Okay, I'll put it on pause. Sure. Well, let's put it back. Okay, so we were through some of the early stuff, got you to Goddard for some reason about the two languages.
Yeah, and so Goddard was only one of, I think, six schools that in the country at that time that would accept me with no foreign language, or less than two foreign languages. And the others were out of my, Claremont Men's College, which is, you have to be a genius, literally, off the scale almost, to get in there. And so that was why.
Yeah, we just run again. It's running again.
I ended up applying to Goddard, which seemed to me the place of my dreams, I guess. I went up there to look at the college, and it certainly fit my interests in mediocre academic level. I mean, basically, they were. Goddard then was a very progressive school, and designed to help people to become independent thinkers, and you know, it had no marks, no grades, no exams. It was a very very progressive school, and of course the neighbors in the area, it's in rural Vermont.
And this would have been in
58.
That is early for that kind of experimentation.
Well, they had been doing it for at least a decade before that. It was based on this sort of John Dewey School of Education, and in fact, the founder and president of the school, Tim Pitkin, who I became very close to, was an apostle of John Dewey, and anyway, to make a long story short, I really blossomed there. I became involved in both academically and in community affairs. I did a thesis on rural zoning in Vermont, which meant that I went to eight communities all over the state. Mm-hmm. The college gave me a car to use to travel, you know, to visit these communities and interview people and so forth. And I've reread my thesis that I wrote then recently, and it's quite an interesting thing. And so I became very, very active and involved. One of the reasons, and I would say probably a primary reason, that I was finally led to though not specifically IBS, but to this kind of work that I ended up in Laos, was one of my professors, Alan Walker, who was a Quaker, who was his field was psychology and community development, and I got interested in community development through working with him from almost the time that I came to the school.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me start thinking internationally, which I hadn't done till then. I had been you know, thanks to partly, I guess, to a small extent, to my education, my pre-college education in a Quaker school here in Philadelphia, I became aware of social issues and the need to, you know, work with the community, of the fact that there were poor people. I mean, I grew up in a family where there was not poverty at all, and in fact, they were reasonably wealthy, my parents.
Mentioned your father went into Philadelphia. What did he do there?
He worked in he and his brothers founded a company that made boxes, metal edge boxes, and through the 40s and 50s, through the war, they made a lot of money, unfortunately, selling these boxes, which are the strongest boxes made, because they have metal edges down the corners. And you still see them now, these days. company's obviously long since sold. My father's deceased, but it was they made a lot of money from the military selling these boxes for, you know, air parts for planes and military equipment and so forth. And that was a source of some problems between me and my parents, the fact of how the money, how the company became a success story and so forth.
Yeah.
They ended up making not only boxes, but designing machinery to make boxes, which they then sold to other people to make boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And my one of my uncles, my father's brother, also, in addition to patenting these metal-edged boxes, designed the handle lock bag, which is they still use today. You know, it folds under and you carry it. Like
right.
And I guess, you know, partly because my parents sold the farm, which I was very unhappy about at the time, though I since came to accept it. But in those, at that time, I was 16 years old when they sold it. This is obviously I was still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I was very upset by that. I mean, to me, that the farm represented my entire life, and I loved it very much. And then the money issue, and a lot of my parents' friends, which I couldn't, I just couldn't identify with, you know, very hoity-toity types of people, and then, you know, and they moved to the city in Philadelphia, and so we somewhat grew apart, myself and my parents, and I wouldn't say we were totally alienated. I mean, I came home and, you know, it wasn't like that, but I at least psychologically there was some, you know, sort of drive to go away from home, which is partly, again, what led me to Laos.
And then that combines with the influence of this instructor at Goddard.
Absolutely, yeah. Who was a pacifist. A Quaker and a pacifist, and started me thinking about pacifism, though not in any specific context. We're talking now 1959, 60, 61, 60, you know, up to 63 when I graduated. I you know, got involved first in the civil rights movement. We organized a lot of support work for the civil rights movement from the school. I was one of the main organizers of an auction where we went around to the farms and communities around the school and collected, you know, voluntary contributions for this, and we used it to try and educate the local population. In Vermont, they're very independent thinkers, have always been, and unlike the neighbor state in New Hampshire, which is quite conservative, Vermonters are generally, though not all, at least liberal, if not very progressive. On the other hand, there were some very hardcore conservative people there, and when we were going around, you know, with a truck, getting furniture and different things that people would give, I distinctly remember coming to one farmhouse, and the man, and we called ahead, and I don't know what we were told, but we got there, and the man was standing on a porch with a shotgun, and, you know, swearing at us, and not going to help the goddamn niggers and all this stuff. He was a minority, because most people, you know, at the time, the civil rights movement was the Freedom Rides really the activity around the civil rights movement was coming to a crescendo at that time, and we raised through that auction, I forget, several thousand dollars, which we sent to Congress of Racial Equality, and became a mobilizing influence at the school, at the college, and as well as in the community. I mean, we got in the papers. It was in the, and it was in the Vermont papers. I think somebody picked it up on the wire that we had raised all this money through mm-hmm. this auction and all. And so, unfortunately, as a footnote, the money never got to, it got to the Congress of Racial Equality, but it apparently got diverted somewhere along the line and didn't get to the people that for whom it was intended. I don't quite know the story on that, but it was the money, though we, it was received, and we got a phone call or a letter or something saying it was received, but somehow somebody pocketed it. Which was really a bummer for those of us that had worked very hard.
Oh, yeah. Much worse than the actual theft of whatever amount it was.
Right. Then we I did a year in Denmark in a program called the Scandinavian Seminar in the summer of 60, I'm sorry, I'm doing these things out of order, and I hope you get it right, but 60, 61 in my, between my junior and senior, my sophomore and junior year,
uh-huh.
I did a year in a program called the Scandinavian Seminar, which still is existing today, and went to Denmark, learned Danish, learned to speak and write Danish, and worked in various jobs that I had there. I went to a folk high school, which is sort of an adult school. It's long, for, you know, over 100 years, this folk high school movement that's for people of all ages, literally from teens mm-hmm. to the 90s. And
never heard of it.
It's a very popular movement in throughout Scandinavia.
Mm.
And so I was in a school with a very straight-laced principal, a guy that had fought the Nazis, interestingly enough, but was very disciplinarian and very, very traditional
mm-hmm.
fellow, who didn't seem to like Americans very much, I must say. I didn't ever got that clear, but anyway, did pretty well there. And then I had these different jobs. I worked at Tivoli, which is the amusement mm-hmm. park mm-hmm. in Copenhagen. I worked at a tire warehouse, lifting tires, you know, mountains of tires lifting them. And I lived with two different families, one on a farm way up in Jutland, which is the northern island and peninsula of Denmark, and then in an island to the south of Copenhagen called Lolland Falster, with a doctor and his family. Worked in I had another job. Anyway, finally ended up there translating a book, a Danish book, translated into English. And all in all, that was a very important experience in the context of IVS, because part of we got interested in there with various people that I knew in Denmark in something which we actually sat down and talked about setting up something called the International Development Project. We had long meetings into the night with students from all over the world, and we actually had a charter written up. I mean, it was, and then it all sort of fizzled out. But it was, for me, that experience of sitting in at very close, you know, on a face-to-face, person-to-person basis over, you know, a couple of weeks, with people from India, from Latin America, from all over, and talking about, putting some of our ideas into action, which I got into, as I say, through my close friendship with this professor who taught me about community development,
mm-hmm.
a field of work that I'd never even heard of until I got to Goddard. So that was another major influence. And then by the time I was, that was been 1961, and I believe, I don't remember the date exactly, but I got a draft notice. You might remember the lottery system that was put in place in those years. Somehow my number came up, and
I thought the lottery was later.
It might have been, I don't remember, 62 or early 63 when it finally came. I don't remember I was 21 in 61, but
mm-hmm.
might have been 62 or 3. I have some files. I could look that up if you wanted, but.
No.
I got a draft notice, and I suddenly, mm-hmm. this got my attention because I already had a consciousness about Vietnam, very, very generalized, but already coming to the pacifist way of thinking at that time, thanks again in large part to this professor, as well as some reading, you know, Gandhi and Martin Luther King, talking about nonviolence. And so I had to meet with the draft board, and I filed for
mm-hmm.
conscientious objector status.
Well, your own religious upbringing was Quaker, right?
No.
No, it wasn't?
No, not.
You mentioned the strictly. Quaker.
My parents
influence.
Were nominally, very nominally Jewish.
Oh, okay.
But the Quaker influence through high school and then with this professor. And my parents were very open. I mean, they said whatever religion or no religion, whatever
mm-hmm.
you choose, we support.
Okay.
And
I just heard all these Quaker references,
right,
so I just assumed.
I was not brought up a Quaker. In fact,
mm-hmm.
Quite the contrary. I really became a Quaker in a formal sense when I was at Goddard.
Oh, okay.
We would have, we'd meet in this professor's home along with about 10, 15, 20 people
mm-hmm.
every Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, you know, and sit in a silent meeting, you know,
mm-hmm.
sitting around in a circle. And that was a profound influence on me. It really got me to, and I did a lot more reading about Quakerism then.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe my experience at in high school for all those years, you know, where we had Quaker meeting as well, but in those years I used to sort of, I mean, it was a joke, or not a joke, but it was sort of a chore to go to
mm-hmm.
a Quaker
mm-hmm.
meeting, and we'd have to sit and listen to one of the guys who always stood up and spoke. This was supposedly a silent meeting, but you know, in Quaker meeting, anyone can speak if the spirit moves them. And but Dr. McFedrin spoke every time, and it was so
predictable. Moved a lot by the spirit.
Yeah, right. And he had to speak, and that was sort of a standing joke in the school. parenthetically, I and a couple of other kids in the high school in my class got so down on it that one Thursday morning when we had the meeting in the winter, and so they had the radiators were all turned on, you know, to
mm-hmm.
keep the place warm. And just before a meeting, we got in the meeting house. Nobody was there, and we went in and put Limburger cheese in the radiator. So,
really?
And by the time people were gathering, it was really quite strong odor, and you know, being a traditional institution, they decided to meet anyway, right?
And, oh, no.
You know, and Dr. McFedrin just would not have it if we didn't have the meeting, and so everybody was enduring through the smell of Limburger cheese, which was strong.
Kind of backfired.
Yeah, yeah. And, but they never found out who did it. You know, they,
well, now you put it on the table.
Yes, right, right.
You told
well,
all.
I had about one-third or one-fourth responsibility on all of those four others, but I will say.
We can shave the sentence if you rat on your co-conspirators.
Yeah. Emma, our daughter, always loves to tell this story, along with several others that I've told. But so all of these influences came together when I had to really very quickly decide what to do when I applied for, when I got my draft notice.
Well, you could at least claim the Quaker religion at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wrote a very long and detailed essay about why I refused to serve in the military, refused to kill people, that my belief in nonviolence, acknowledged that, you know, the reality of the military, but that this, I refused to be part of it, that I would not carry a weapon or kill people. And then I had to meet with, I wrote that and sent that to the draft board, you know, all the forms and everything. And then I had to meet the draft, you know, they require you to be there and show up, and they talk to you. Now, being in Philadelphia, the draft board was relatively easy because there are so many Quakers there and they're used to it. But if you're in rural Idaho or in you know, New Hampshire or somewhere where
or
they've
Texas.
Never heard of it, yeah, Texas, exactly. People applying for CO status then as well as right up to today. I mean,
I'm sure.
It's very hard. Some places they think you're kind of, I mean, they don't take it seriously because they don't even, they claim at least some draft boards, well, there are no draft boards today, but when you file, you still have to file for CO status.
Mm.
You know,
I didn't know.
Well, it's a voluntary army, but yeah, I mean, things, everything's changed. But if you want to be a CO, you might still have to go through that. It's very hard, especially for people who are in the military who realize then that they have either philosophical or religious reasons that they didn't know. I mean, a lot of people are in the military and don't know that there is any. Legal basis that you can be a CO. It's very hard today, and there are several cases that have gone to the Supreme Court of people who have refused, you know, who are in the military, and then they realized, and it's quite a, I mean, it's a major thing, although less so without the draft, much less.
Right.
I mean, once you sign up for the military, you sort of give them, sign away your rights, and you know, there are people that have faced that problem. Anyway, make a long story short, I ended up having to find a job. I mean, the draft board agreed with my, said, okay, we give you 1-0 status, which is the number as a CO, and 1-AO is with medical disability, and 1-0 is full conscientious objector status. And so I had, I think, 2 weeks or whatever it was to find a job, and I'm trying to remember, but anyway, I ended up in Indianapolis working at a social service agency called Flanner House, again, which is still there, where I was teaching young African Americans, which in a ghetto environment. We had employment clinics, and we set up the you know, sort of a role-playing situation in a little office that we had in the ghetto, and then people would come in, and the idea was to try and teach them how to apply for a job, okay?
How to go through an interview and things
right,
like that.
Right.
Okay.
and probably at least half of the people coming in were functionally illiterate, not mm-hmm. entirely, but basically functionally illiterate, and some were teens, some were older, and the Flanner House was almost, I was the only Caucasian working there, everyone else was black. And so my role in this role playing was the white employer. And, you know, we're talking during a period when there was a lot, though it still exists, but then much, and certainly in Indiana, in Indianapolis, where, you know, a stronghold of the Ku Klux Klan and everything, a lot of racism. So I would play a role of, we don't hire niggers here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, it was everybody knew we were, it was role-playing. This was not
right.
a real situation, but
hopefully they
one guy realize. Lost it, and he got, he forgot that, and he
oh,
stood
yeah.
up, and he was 10, he was, you know, calling him a nigger. And I said, wait, we're, this role-playing, you know, he still, they had to, people restrain him, you know, because he'd forgotten him.
I don't know if I would like that job. I mean, that would be really tough to be that kind of person when you're not.
Well, I mean, it was acting as
know,
well,
but
I mean, because before we started the role playing. It was a great learning experience for me. I don't mm-hmm. know about the people in these clinics, but I really learned a lot. However, unfortunately, I became at odds with my boss there, who a woman, African American woman, who was the daughter of the founder of Flanner House,
mm-hmm.
who was quite conservative. It turns out was a Republican, and she. She and I differed, and I had been on my own time. Mind you, this was with a federal, I think it was Department of Labor mm-hmm. grant that they were, this program mm-hmm. was, and so I was receiving federal money, and she called me into her office one day and said, you're working for the, what was his name? He's still in get his name now, but he's still in Congress, the first Democrat to be named to run and win as a member of Congress from Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very Republican state, and
still is.
It still is. And I said, Harriet Reynolds was her name. I said, Harriet, that's true, I have, but it's on my own time. She just went wild, said, you can't do this. This is a Taft-Hartley violation of the, you know, except doing money on your own. You can't work, have two jobs
true.
If you work for the government.
Well,
it's been abrogated since then, but
okay.
It used to be
that way?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
And,
so she was upset, sort of legitimately, in effect.
Right. I said, Harriet, you're working for the Republican, aren't you? And I knew she was campaigning for him.
Uh-huh.
And she, you know, she said, well, I'll give you two alternatives, quit or I'll fire you right
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I called a spade a spade. I mean, if I'd backed down and said, all right, I won't do it,
mm-hmm.
I could have stayed, but I was not going to do that. And
well, especially if she's being a hypocrite about it.
Exactly. So I said, rather than have this on my record that I was fired, I will resign.
Uh-huh.
And so that was that. So then the draft board said I had, I don't know, it was 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever, to find another job, or
uh-huh, uh-huh.
they informed me you were working in a mental institution, mopping floors for.
Uh-huh.
the next 2 years. See, it's 3 years. You had to do 3 years.
Oh, I thought it was only two.
No.
Oh, okay.
2 years in the military, but 3 years if you're a conscientious objector.
Oh, okay.
And that's, I had been there, well, it was 8 months then at that point. And so I was very anxious to find another job, but I went straight to the library and started looking, you know, what could I do? And I don't quite remember how, but I either was a brochure or something I read about this organization called IBS, and I got a phone number and I called them and said I was interested in explaining my situation as a CO and all. And you know, it was like a week later or 3 days later or whatever, John Hughes flew out to Indianapolis and we met in the airport, sitting at a table there, and he offered me a job right there after, I mean, I'd sent and filed an application, and
right.
I guess they checked my references and all of that, and then...
this was the job interview.
Yeah. But as he since told me, he said, we needed people and we needed bodies and you look good. And I said, well, I may look good, but you found out different when I went over there. But
well, we can make mistakes.
I said, but so he said at the interview, he said, well, we have two different two choices for you. You want to go to Vietnam or you want to go to Laos. And to be quite frank, I mean, I knew of a country called Laos, but I'd never really considered. And I barely knew. I just knew there was, this is October 64, right?
Okay.
So I knew that that there was a war going on, and I knew I didn't want to be part of it. And I knew I was still feeling pacifist inclinations.
So you didn't want Vietnam.
Right. So I said, I'll go to Laos. Now, John, and we've talked a lot about it since, I still know him, he's now a real estate agent out here in Maryland, and you know, good friends. In fact, I saw him at this event where the Cambodian ambassador was. And, and at the time, the director of IVS was Arthur Gardner. I don't know if you remember Arthur Z. Gardner, who was previously the director of AID in Vietnam. And I guess he left AID and became the director of IVS. Essentially, Gardner certainly wasn't telling John Hughes what the U.S. was doing in Indochina, let alone in Laos, to the extent he might have known about it. I don't know, but I'm assuming as an ambassador in Vietnam, he knew
something.
He knew quite a bit. I don't know, remember his years. He was, I think he only came to IVS maybe a matter of months or a year at most before I was joining. So, at any rate, no one ever told me, you know, there was a war going on in Laos, a secret war, of course. And it was then I said, well, I'll go to Laos. I don't want to carry a gun. I don't want to kill people. I don't want to go into war situation, so I'll go to Laos. And
famous last words.
That's right. And I think it was like the same week, maybe less than a week later, I was in, we had our orientation down in West Virginia at Harper's Ferry, where all the IVS still does their training. And 3 days, I think, of language, very minimal training in law and language. They had both IVSers for Laos and Vietnam, and they divided us up. And
That's when you met, when you would have met Emily.
Elaine, yeah.
Elaine, Emily, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And John, what was it?
Joanne.
Joanne, right.
Yeah. O-N-N. There were about, as I recall, maybe 25 or 30 of us there. I don't remember exactly, but maybe more, I don't know. I distinctly remember part of the training was a film, U.S. government film, about what to do if you're about to be captured, or sort of a very strange film, and it was a sort of done with actors, right? It wasn't real. It wasn't on the spot in Vietnam or in Laos. They didn't mention Laos, of course. It was mainly about Vietnam, but shown to all of us, right?
Uh-huh.
And I've since done some research on this film, and because I found some IVS stuff in my files, gave the name of the film, so I checked back and find out it was made by the CIA, this film.
so what to do?
Yeah, right. But of course, even then, and Gardner, I think Gardner was there. I'm pretty sure he was at this training. And again, there was no mention to, I mean, he could have taken us aside, those of us going to Laos, and said, here's the situation.
You know, it's not as calm as you might think.
Right. And as I remember, they told us about the land of a million elephants, you know, which it's known as, and of course, many of those elephants were killed during the war, but not a word. So I land in Laos in October, it was October 24th, or I can't remember exactly, but it was the latter part of October. And immediately, Chet Brown was our chief of party, who I really, a lot of people put Chet down as an old fogey or something like that, but Chet and I always got along very well. And later, Bob Lovin was the chief of party.
Mm-hmm. I'll be seeing him in a couple of days.
Right, he's a real, real good first class guy.
Mm-hmm.
Chet, you know, we got there, and I don't remember, I mean, we're talking 30 years ago almost, 29 years ago, right? But I remember almost immediately, within the first 2 or 3 days, I was told that we need to, this IVS volunteer that's been accepted, who's coming, he was supposed to come with you guys, he was, should have been training together and West Virginia, but he was held up because of some problem with his visa or passport, or I don't know what it was, some deal. And he was supposed to go to teach English, and not at Dong Doc, this is with Pop Buell
was it Long Jiang?
No, not Longjiang, which is the CIA station, but the, I always forget the name of it, who was there, that's right, I mean, it's in the survey that I filled out,
name
of the place.
Oh, the first place?
Yeah.
Let's see, Mong Cao?
No.
Sam Tong?
Sam Tong, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sam Tong, which
was
the...
Oh, this is reverse order.
How do I do it? Yeah, I don't know why that you wrote that that way. Yeah, Santong was the first place I went, then Mong Cao, and then Vientiane.
Oh.
And so I was sent to Santong, which was Pop Buell's.
In lieu
time.
Of this other guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Supposedly, like, for a matter of days until his
this guy comes along.
Yeah, right.
Oh, okay.
But I was recruited to do rural development. I wasn't recruited, you know, on basis based of my experience, you know, growing up on a farm and then my training in community development and so forth in school. Certainly not to teach English. I mean, you know, they would have had people that had background in education or teaching or something, and I had nothing in that.
And more importantly, you did have some particular skill that was going to waste while you were doing English, which a lot of people could do.
One would think, yeah.
Well, at least in theory.
This was a very peculiar situation, that is, teaching English to nurses who were Hmong nurses, that is, not Lao.
Right.
So the minimal where I might have, at that point, known a half dozen, maximum 10 words of Lao, I mean 3 days of training, most of which was Ooh. Some was in language training, some was cultural training, and some was films and, you know, the rest of it. You know, a lot of it was just sitting around chit-chat, you know, and talking. So I was not prepared for a war situation, which is what I found. The hospital, these nurses, was a hospital run by Operation Brotherhood, which was a Filipino, I know of it, organization that was contracted ostensibly to AID, that it turns out was a CIA contract, though undercover with AID. Even the OB people, Operation Brotherhood people, didn't know who was the real sponsor of their program. During my time in Laos, I got to know some of the OB people running it, and a couple of them said, "We know, but it's not something we're willing to. We're not going to let them destroy our program here. It's too important. You know, we're helping people. We have hospitals. You know, rehabilitating people, amputees, and everything else. And you know, as long as our bills are paid, you know, in those days, the consciousness about the CIA was a lot less than it is today." But people knew there was this spooky organization, and of course, I'd never heard of it until I got there.
Yeah, and of course, it would be tough for doctors who want to, and nurses who want to relieve suffering.
Exactly,
and they're so focused.
Very humanitarian people with real training in medicine and nursing and doctors,
and they can actually help somebody.
Exactly,
and this other organization is so far in the background. Who cares? Yeah, no, I can understand it. Empathize.
But at the same time, you know, they were living, at least those that knew about it, which was a tiny handful of the total group. I mean, I think they might have had in that hospital, I remember, it was quite large, and the total personnel there must have been a lot more than IBS had. They had a couple of hundred people there, and we were, in Laos, we were, including the education people, Dong Dok and so forth, might have had certainly less than 100, as I remember. We were 50, 60, 70, something like that. So,
well, let me sort of interrupt you here, only because I'm just remembering something. During your time with IVS, during these 3 years, were there any annual reports that were printed up? And just
well, in Washington, or by, I mean, we had the Chuck Brown had to file an annual report. We also had to file.
No, that's not what I meant. Like a booklet that IVS would have produced about, you know, operations and the program.
Yeah,
and
I found in my crate in Philadelphia, I found one of those with my picture on the job. If I can dig it out, I can show you.
I looked at the IVS office, and they don't have any of those any longer.
Really?
So if I could get a photocopy of that
I'll
official
that
stuff,
I'd
very much appreciate it. Because, you know, sometimes, at least in the Vietnam ones, they would have the map of the country with boxes and then arrows to where people were assigned and who was in the country at the same time, and all this kind of basic information that no longer exists even in the central office.
I'm surprised. I would have thought they'd have kept all that.
Apparently with so many different moves, and then you get somebody come along and say, we don't need this, it's, you know, five years old. Or 10 years old, who cares anymore, you know? So a lot of that stuff is missing. And Don has been able to supply me with stuff from Vietnam that he personally kept.
Right.
But for Laos, there's big information gaps. So I'm sorry to interrupt
your
story. I've
also found a ream of correspondence that I had with various people, Chet Brown, Bob Lovin. And so forth. Some of my monthly reports I had to file, was it monthly or weekly, I forget, reports.
I've heard of monthly for Vietnam, I don't know.
Yeah. And I was quite verbose at the time. I had a typewriter that I bought on my way over in Hong Kong, and I still have that typewriter, Olivetti, you know, manual, and so I would go on at some length about my concerns and increasingly my real things that were really troubling me about the program there.
If you look through that and if you find anything that you feel comfortable about sharing,
I'd appreciate that too. But you know, that's certainly your decision. But I'm sorry to interrupt, but just that came to mind when you were.
If I can find it, I mean, that IBS thing, I'll definitely. I hope I can find it today. I spent, as it turned out, about 2 weeks at Samtong, and I was teaching these Hmong nurses basically from 5 to 6 at night, and this is in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
At Samtong, which is about 10 minutes by air on a helicopter, but about 3 days if you walk, if you try to climb through the mountains and all, from Longcheng, which was the CIA's operations base there. And, you know, I was seeing on a daily basis, you know, people coming. I mean, the hospital was there not for local people at all. It was there to try and put people back together that were shot and wounded, and many of them died right there, or were dead when they were brought in. And these Hmong nurses with the Operation Brotherhood doctors, my job was to teach the nurses so they could communicate with the OB people,
right,
who only spoke English, didn't speak any Hmong.
These were the Filipino doctors under the Operation Brotherhood.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I, you know, I didn't speak any Hmong. I mean, I was trying, I was basically teaching sign language, because I could not speak a word of
it. Yeah.
You had
a few words of Lao and nothing of Hmong.
And I remember telling Chet, I said, how could you do this to me? I mean, you know, yeah. It really put me in an impossible situation, not only working with Pop Yule, who was a real fucking, excuse me, son of a bitch. I mean, he really was, don't quote me in the thing, but that's what he was. Everybody knew. I mean, anybody who worked with him. And, I mean, he, I shouldn't do it, but I mean, he swore like a blue streak at everybody, including whether they were Hmong or American or who. And, but the other, the most essential fact was that I couldn't speak any of the language. So there I was trying to communicate with these nurses, and Chet pretty much acknowledged that he didn't realize or didn't stop to think about that. And essentially, that was part of the problem, was that, you know, that IBS was there subordinate to AID, and AID's priority at that time was this program, AID's and CIA's. And, you know, basically IBS was being used as the donkey, you know, to do all the work that AID people couldn't or wouldn't do. And that, I think, applies pretty much across the board in Laos. I don't know about Vietnam, but certainly in Laos, that was our role. I mean, it was sort of a deodorant for what, you know, the larger part of the program there was, which was essentially more of a military, quasi-military, quasi-economic and political, as opposed to helping people help themselves, which was our motto. In IBS. I mean, you know, they were fighting communism, right? That was the top of the list, and everything else had to follow from that. And so, make a long story short, I became, or my relationship with Pop Yule was anything but good, and increasingly alienated from him.
And because of the language that he would use? I mean, you mentioned
language
that.
And his way of working with people. It was, you know, ordering people around and everything. He got the name Pop, and nobody ever knew where the name, I mean, who gave him the name, whether he gave it to himself or the myth was that these kids who were suddenly orphans because of the war that he was basically running, he was the colonel basically in charge of this whole operation in that area, and he was the man running all these, along with some other people, you know, CIA, Air America people, but they were basically, you know, Air America was just running the, you know, it was the CIA's airline, which was bringing the goods in and out, the rice drops, and then the weapons and the ordnance and so forth. which I used to see every day. I mean, I used to see these pallets with ordnance all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm thinking to myself, John Hughes never told me about this, right?
This is no place for
to say nothing of
Quaker
all the,
convert to
right,
be
of all the dead bodies and the blood all over the tarmac. Uh-huh. and all these these Air America guys who were you know, boozing at the same time as flying the planes and so forth. Well, about 2 weeks in, I suddenly got a. I was living way up on the hill, and in a little hut that I had there, and you know, eating rice and whatever I could do, and also I was eating commissary food, you know, which they had there. Suddenly get a call, so a little kid comes running up the hill and says, Tom Pop wants you, you know, come, or, you know, with sign language, because
yeah.
I again still couldn't hardly speak. And so I sort of come down on my own. I'm not going to rush to Pop, you know, he can wait for me, you know, I got other things to do. And so I got there maybe a couple hours later, and I had, so what took you so long, goddamn motherfucking shithead, you? And all this, and on and on and on. I mean, he couldn't say two words straight without swearing. And
I'll just give this a pause. Let me put this back on. Okay.
So I.
So anyway,
Pop says to me
after all those words
and everything, and continuing, he said, "You goddamn motherfucking spoiled brat kid. I know what you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
You shithead." And I said, "Pop, what's all this about?" Says, "You've been fooling around with my nurses." My nurses.
Yeah, yeah. I said, you wrote that. You've been fondling
yeah.
them.
Yeah. Well, you got the story. I said, "Pop, give me a break." I said, "That's the last thing on my mind." I didn't even want to. This was not on my.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And he interrupted me. He said, "Yeah, don't give me that shit. You're just a young kid wants to have a good time and all this." I said, "Stuff it," or something. I don't know what I said. I said, "You can stuff that where the sun doesn't shine," or something. You know, I tried to talk back to him. Of course, he didn't like that.
In his own language.
Yeah, right. And says, "Get your fucking motherfucking ass out of my operation. You don't belong here, and I don't need you. And what's more, Chet Brown doesn't know what the hell he's doing, and so get out of here."
Uh-huh.
He said, "You're on the next flight out of here." I said, see ya, Pop." Well,
it was the best thing he could have done for you.
Yeah, it really was. But the reason was, had nothing to do with the nurses. Of
uh-huh.
course, I wasn't messing around with the nurses. I mean, you know, at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, it starts to get dark in the mountains. I mean,
uh-huh.
it is dark by 6 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't. All we had was generators and candles, and we didn't have any electricity. So, you know, he was trying to make something with that. But there was an excuse because I had been, "Magic, come here." I had been asking, you know, some questions about Long Chang what's going on.
You were too curious.
Yeah, and it must have gotten back to him. I wasn't asking him, but others. And there was a lot of people around there, including some former IVSers who were, and some IVSers that were around, as it were. I mean, I was the only one that was formerly there, but Wynn McKeithen was an IVSer who'd gone to work with AID,
mm-hmm.
and one or two others, I forget, that were sort of around, in and out on temporary duty, but they were
these were all former IVSers.
Yeah,
there
as
no,
was Pop. Pop was former IVSers.
That's right. Yeah, but I mean,
and then AID, and then finally CIA.
Yeah, but you were the only one currently IVS
right.
who was there.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. See, because I was wondering if there were any
no, individuals. No, that's not true. There was. What was his name? There was another IVSer that came in there. Not well. I think he went in after I was there. But I knew him. Darn if I can't remember his name. I'm sure it's in one of my monthly reports I can find. But there was a guy that was an irrigation specialist, as I recall.
Mm.
that was there. Can't remember his name, but it will probably come back. But I was the only one there during those 2 weeks that I was supposed to be there. Right?
No, I was just wondering you, because I know about the IVS onto AID, and for many people that was it, just AID.
Right.
And then possibly also AID as a cover for CIA for a few others.
Right.
In fact, one fellow I talked to even said that that's what he really was when he was AID. But I didn't know if individuals, while they were still officially IVS, would be put in that situation.
No. There was I'll just parenthetically mention, there was a case of a guy, Fred Carlson. There were two Carlson, there were two brothers,
Gus and
Fred.
And
Gus. Yes.
Yeah, I've interviewed Gus, and Fred is somewhere out of country now, so I can't see him.
Well, I'll just tell you without being attributed to me that Fred, please, I don't wish, because I know, but I'll just tell you that Fred was sort of an adventurer type, and I'm confused. Was it Fred or was it Gus? I think it was Fred. That, Gus, I think, was a little more straight and a reasonable guy, but Fred ended up flying at one point in a helicopter, Air America helicopter, up to the China border.
Mm.
Ostensibly, he was into construction, right?
Both
and
were,
his,
actually.
Yeah.
I mean, if Fred was, I know Gus was.
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope I'm right about Fred being the one now. I'm sure, again, it's in some of the stuff I wrote. And he went up to the China border. I mean, he had no business going there, and certainly not in Air America with, definitely with CIA people, there'd be nobody else going up.
Mm-hmm.
No IVS or AID people going up to the China border, right?
Mm-hmm. Not legitimate AID people.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, I think there should be the distinction made.
And they got shot at by the Chinese.
Well, I'm sure
they
did.
I mean, it could have been an international incident, you know, and they were taken off and they had to haul ass out of, to get out of there before they were shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved to talk about this. I mean, it was he that brought it up. Nobody knew about it until at least any of us. And he got drinking one night and he started talking, you know, bragging about how he'd been to the China border and almost got shot down and all this stuff. And he thought he was a great hero, right?
Yeah.
And we all said, Fred, you're nuts. What the hell are you doing? and I think he got dressed down at the time by Chet Brown, you know, which really could have got us in a real mess.
Yeah, because it would taint the whole organization and put a lot of people at risk.
Exactly.
I would suspect that you're right.